on a company business a while back, and while I was there, I didn't have nothing to do. Actually, I was an American, so I didn't have nothing to do, so I drove over to Albany to go to an AA meeting and eat at this Italian restaurant. And the Italian food was good. So was the speaker over there. And
I didn't speak in an Italian restaurant.
You didn't? And, well, I was at that group over there in Albany, though. And I went to Macon the following weekend. And I was talking with Sandy and Tommy, and Sandy goes, "There goes our speaker." I said, "That's the guy that spoke in Albany." You know? I really enjoyed his talk then. But he said he wasn't going to wear a tie tonight, but I brought him one. And I gave it to him, and he ain't going to wear it. Now, y'all tell me what's wrong with this tie. Nothing wrong with that. It's right here for you.
It doesn't matter.
Come on up, Chuck.
I'm sure glad that that I didn't pay him anything before this getting up here, because you ought to heard his rates for saying something nice about you, you know. Man, I'll tell you what. This has been kind of a crazy weekend so far. To start with, I drove right by my hotel because there was a sort of an establishment between the interstate and the hotel called Hooters. And, you know, I just couldn't seem to get my vision to go past that building, you know. And I just pulled in off the interstate and ended up here. And Gary says, "Well, I'll take you back out there and show you where the hotel is and everything like that." And then they told me I didn't have a room. Then they put me in a room, and I looked out the window, and guess what was outside the window? Hooters. And you see, that is really one of my addictions. I swear, you know. I was going to tell y'all that before we ever get going here, that I need for y'all to understand that I have an addictive personality. Seriously addictive personality. All five of my basic senses are addictive by nature. If it looks good, tastes good, smells good, sounds good, or feels good, as far back as I can remember, I've been inclined to try it without thinking about the consequences. And there was always consequences, you know. And so, and usually if I convinced myself that it made me feel good, I did it to excess every time. And the other thing is, and I got a kick out of this, let me tell you, I got the flyer, and it gave the Saturday night speaker as Charles V. from Milledgeville. And I started to get on the phone. I thought, man, you know, it's messed up here. Because I haven't been called Charles in 50 years. I got nicknamed Chuck a long time ago, and that's what everybody, I think, in AA circles knows me as. And so then I got to thinking, uh-oh, wait a minute. That might be strategy. They might have put... Then Jack's capable of doing stuff like that, too. Yeah. Yeah, he probably put Charles V on there, so maybe kind of get more people here, you know, because they might not know who he was, you know. But anyway, I'm an alcoholic. My name's Chuck Vandiver, and I'm from the institution city of Milledgeville, Georgia. And part of my story is right there in Milledgeville, Georgia. Believe. And I want to tell you, I appreciate the committee. Well, I don't know whether I do or not. The committees should not always listen to one of their members when they recommend somebody as a speaker. Because I'm not a speaker. I'm really not. I don't ever intend to be a speaker. Now, I'm a sharer. I am a big time sharer, but I'm not a speaker. So if you're here looking for a speaker tonight, go back and get something else to eat. Because I'm sure there's some left back there. And I'll go with you. Anyway, I've really been having a good time since I got here yesterday. And I'm not going to let me being up here making a share, a sharing with you, cause it to be any different. You know, when I got to this fellowship, committee, I appreciate it. I appreciate it. I'm not grateful, I just appreciate it. I'm also a person that has been on a journey of some type or other just about all my life. And I need to go back to that point and tell you that, my sobriety day is first January the 10th, 1981. And it's only that by the grace of God and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and God communicating with me through you on a daily basis. And this is good. But I was an only child, and I liked that. And my family got married. My mom and dad got married late in life. And when I was old enough to realize how old they were, I began to wonder about me. And they finally assured me, you know, through photographs and what have you, paid documents and stuff, that I was for real. You know, I wasn't adopted or anything. You know, I got here like I was supposed to. Kind of unexpected, but I got here anyway. But my dad was a tobacconist for 47 years, and he traveled everywhere they grew tobacco. All over the places in the United States, mostly the Southeast, and in England, and a couple of times in South America. So I was always on some kind of journey. And when I got to be 16 years old, I decided, you know, I had developed a lot of attitudes. like fear and not feeling quite good enough, inadequate. And I was a loner. And I decided, well, you know, this being a loner ain't worth too much, because I'm lonely. So I picked a group of kids. I was 16 years old. I was playing football and baseball, and as long as I was out there playing on that ball field, I felt a part of, you know. I was a member of the team. But you couldn't live out there, see. And when the practice and the games were over with and we left the field, everybody was leaving with their buddies and what have you, and I was leaving by myself. And of course, at 16, you know, the girls start looking different. And that group attracted my interest, too, there. And Hooters, you know. And that's where I first became addicted to Hooters. And it wasn't even an establishment yet. So anyway, you know, the only place I really felt comfortable and felt like I belonged was in the back seat of the car that we traveled in to different places. And I got some strange credentials. I'm the only person that I have met in or out of AA that belongs to four high school senior classes. I figured that one out. Just leave it. No, I'm not going to leave it. I start to school every year in North Carolina, a place called Kempston, North Carolina. And I'd go 3 months there, and then I'd either go to Greenville, Tennessee or Harrisburg, Kentucky. And do 3 more months there. And then 3 months south of here at a place called Moultrie, Georgia. And I would spend 3 months there. And usually Moultrie had me longer than anybody else, because sometimes I'd get to stay there all summer, which added 3 more months to it. I'm sort of like, I need to tell you all this before I go any further. I plan to open with what I'm about to tell you and got carried away. But ladies, y'all got to stay with me on this, because this is really for y'all. And it's about the creation of the animal species. and the monkey was created first. And it was trying to be decided how much sex life each species got, and the monkey got 10 years of sex life, and the monkey says, whoa, wait a minute. I need more sex life than that. Said, I'm going to be important with space and science and medical experiments and movies and zoos and stuff. So the monkey got 10 extra years, which gave him 20. Then the lion, the king of the jungle, was created. And the lion got 10 years, and the lion let out a roar. He said, whoa, said, I'm the king of the jungle, the head of my species, important to zoos and movies and stuff. I deserve as much sex life as the monkey. So the lion got 10 extra years, which gave him 20. Then the jackass was created. And the jackass was given 10 years, and here comes some big jackass tears, you know. And the jackass says, I know I'm going to be considered more stubborn and stupid than the other two species, but I'm going to be a beast of burden all my life, and I deserve as much sex life as the monkey and the lion. So the jackass got 10 extra years, which gave him 20. Then man, the master species, was created. And right off the bat, he was going to be the master species. He got 20 years normal sex life, and man said, uh-uh. So if I'm going to be the master species and I'm going to be responsible for all these others, I'm going to need 50 years. Well, sex life was running a little scarce about this time. So the word chronological was created. And that sort of means that the lower species won't live as long as the master species and won't need as much sex life. So 10 of the monkeys, 10 of the lions, and 10 of the jackasses was taken away from them, which adds up to 30. With man's already 20, he gave him his 50 years of sex life. Okay? Y'all are with me? To there? Okay. And that's why, to this day, man has 20 years of normal sex life, 10 years of monkey, 10 years of monkeying around, 10 years of lying about it, and 10 years of making an ass out of himself. And I always like to kind of sit back after I tell that joke, and I look at the ladies, and every one of them are grinning like a sheep eating briars, and some of the men are scratching their heads and trying to figure out where they are in there. That's really... Well, that's sort of... Man, you know, I was like sort of like that in my journeys, you know? I just really wasn't sure where I was, you know? So I really been on a journey, and 16 years old, I wanted to be a part of, I wanted to belong, I wanted to fit in. I picked a group of kids out and watched them, observed them, and they drank. But they made it look fun. Well, now you see, up till that point in my life, I did not like alcohol. Matter of fact, I hated alcohol. And I hated cigarettes, too. Sure did. And the reason I didn't like alcohol is because I had two aunts and two uncles and a grandmother and a grandfather on one side of my family that died alcohol-related deaths before I ever took my first drink. And I didn't realize it until I came to this fellowship. I was powerless over alcohol before I got here and before I ever took my first drink. Because I didn't want those people to drink, because it put up a barrier for me to love them and for them to love me and show it in any way. And then on the other hand, the other side of my family was angry all the time at the one that was drunk all the time. And I didn't like that either, because that was another barrier. Sometimes they took it out on me and I wasn't even drinking yet. And I was powerless over their anger, and I was powerless over their drinking, and that didn't really help my feelings and attitude about being inadequate. So I already felt bad about that. So anyway, as much as I hated alcohol, I wanted to fit in worse. I wanted to be accepted, to be a part of. And my attitude and way of thinking at the time was already alcoholic, because I was thinking, I got to prove to them kids that I can drink with them, that I can do it successfully. And I did. And
I believe it's been referred to as our sobriety is magic sometimes. That's what I thought my drinking was. Lord have mercy, I lit up like a neon sign after I took that first drink. Whew. I could almost feel my toenails curling, you know. Because, I mean, it just, the minute it hit my mouth and I swallowed, it went everywhere. It was like an explosion of alcohol every time I drank it did that. It didn't just go to my stomach, it went pew, everywhere. I know it tickles me when I hear some medical authorities tell you how alcohol does, you know, you swallow it and it gets in your stomach, some of your organisms take care of some of it, and the rest of it goes through your stomach lining into your bloodstream, into your heart, and to your brain, and it comes out of the bloodstream and mixes with other chemicals in the brain and does brain damage, and I thought, damn, that's, you know, pretty complicated. And then I got to this fellowship, and all y'all said was I was allergic to alcohol. You know, hell, I keep it simple. You know. And that's what I believe in doing. But anyway, me and my alcohol became closer companions than anything else I had in my life. Me and my alcohol played football games together. Ran the wrong way a couple of times in football games together. Got thrown out of football games together. He got thrown out of high school a couple of times together. Finally, I had to stay in one school a whole year, for a whole 9 months. And I ended up at GMC in Milledgeville. That was my first time in Milledgeville. And I swore up and down, if I ever got out of that place, I'd never go back. Never, ever. You know, because I was scared to death of that state hospital. I couldn't figure out why, but I was scared to death. You know, I was slipping out of the barracks the night after taps and going to the closest liquor store and getting liquor and bringing it back to the barracks and climbing the sheets back up to the second floor and drinking it and coming to the next morning and wondered why I was scared of the state hospital. Never thought I'd be working out there later on. Anyway, finished high school there. That was my fourth senior class. And you know, folks, I've been to all four senior class reunions and just had a ball. You know, and they treated me just like I walked up there and got my diploma with them. And I didn't. But anyway, that's what alcoholics can do. Even when they're sober, they can still act drunk. And went to the University of Georgia in 1949. And boy, that just, for a teenage drunk, that was the place to be. Yes, sir. I don't know, some of y'all know what the campus looks like up there then, but back then where the Coliseum is at the University of Georgia now, the old baseball field used to be there. And I had played pretty good baseball in high school. And I took two or three drinks and chewed up about half a pack of breath mints and walked across campus to the ball field and walked up to a fellow named Jim Watley, who was the head coach then, and told him I wanted to play baseball. And he asked me what I played, and I told him, I said, I pitch, I'm left-handed, and you don't have one. And he said, you're right. And he sent me down and put some practice uniform on, and I pitched batting practice that day at 9 o'clock the next morning. I was in Wally Butts' office signing a full grant and aid scholarship in baseball at the University of Georgia. To show you how much gratitude I had, I did pretty good for 2 years. I got to my senior year before the season ever got here. One day, I decided in training quarters that I wanted a drink, a couple of drinks. I went out and bought a fifth to get them two drinks out of them. Does it sound familiar? You know. And I drank every bit of that fifth. I don't think I shared it with anybody. And I got caught, and I got kicked out of the university. That's how much I appreciated the scholarship. And that would have probably been one of my best years, if not my best year in baseball. Anyway, I had finished ROTC, Reserve Officers Training, and being a senior, I was eligible to receive a commission as a second lieutenant. So me and my alcohol went into the Army and went through Associate Officer School at Fort Benning, and when we finished there, decided to celebrate and got my dress uniform on and went across the river to a place called Phoenix City, Alabama. To one of their more worthy attractions called Mall Beaches. People, I want to tell you something. I was not a fighting drunk. I was a loving drunk. My problem was I didn't know how to love. But I was a loving drunk. I was not a fighter. And that seemingly was what they wanted to do over there in Phoenix City. Because I walked in that place called Mall Beaches, and a chair hit the wall over here, and a beer bottle hit the wall over here, and I did the prettiest about face you ever saw. And went to a little higher class establishment called the Hole in the Wall. They had some names over there, and there was a hole in the wall, I want to tell you. Anyway, I got just toe-up drunk, passing out, blackout drunk, and on Sunday morning, one of my fellow officers helped me come to. See, I had quit waking up by now. I'd come to, that's all. And did y'all ever hear about the two? I'm sorry. I'm here to have a good time, and I'm coming out of this. Now, I hope that wasn't you, Mike. Anyway, and the people that listen to this tape gonna wonder about that, aren't they? For the audio audience, that was my coat. Okay. Told me that I had gotten my military occupational specialty that weekend, and I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. And he said, "You've got you an MRS." And I said, "What is it?" He said, "You signed up for Airborne Rangers." People are loving drunk, don't do stuff like that. And even a lot of fighting ones don't. And I thought they were kidding me until I went down and checked on it. And I did. And I tried everything but AWOL to get out of that and couldn't, because there was a thing going on called the Korean conflict. And folks, I'm going to tell y'all something. With all due respect, there may be some airborne people in this room. With all due respect to each of you, I was scared to death from start to finish. Really. Really scared. I was already full of fear about everything else. Now it was like the everyday airborne rangers. Yeah. If you have never had to get out of the bed at 5 o'clock in the morning, strap a parachute on, walk out to a plane, get on it, and be taken 5 to 10,000 feet up in the air and ordered to jump out of that plane with a hangover, you ain't lived yet. Try that one time. It's an experience, I want to tell you. And the strange thing about it is, in my alcoholic nature, I did all my training jumps, and then somebody said, "Well, you know, the more jumps you make, the more extra money you make." And I thought, I ain't that damn scared. I'm gonna get some extra jumps in. And I did 36 of them. And I want to tell you something, folks. It's a good thing that they require jumpers, troopers, to blouse their britches when they jump. Because there were several times there that I jumped hungover. And one time I was drunk. That if my britches had not been bloused, everything and everybody directly underneath me would have been in a mess. I'm serious. I'm serious. When them static chutes open that thing up, it turns you hell of a witchy way, but the way you expecting to go, it's bad. But anyway, I ended up in Korea and ended up from there in the Army Hospital in Honolulu above Schofield Barracks, and I stayed there for about 4 months and thought I was fixing to get a medical discharge, you know. And they just suddenly told me, no, we're going to send you home for 30 days and you're going to Europe for 26 months. I said, okay, just as long as I don't have to be shot at or jump out of no planes. And they said, okay, and I did. I went over there, finished my military time, and I came home and I met a little gal down in Moultrie, Georgia, and we got married and we started a family. And I went back to the University of Georgia and worked full time up there and finished my degree. Started to work on my master's. I could identify with you a little there. Never did finish my master's, but I started to work on it. Anyway, a job seemed more important than the rest of my master's. Yeah. Needed a little more drinking money. So I started out in YMCA work and Young Men's Christian Association. That was not compatible to my condition at the time. And that lasted about 2 years. And then I went to Kinston, North Carolina, where I had played football, and got the job there as head baseball coach and defensive football coordinator. And I stayed there for about 3 years and left. Just actually left. I mean, I had probably the best job in the whole state of North Carolina. I had 2 state championship teams out of 3 years and just left. Just packed up and left. And then I went to Anniston, Alabama and became city recreation director there for 2 years. Good job. Packed up and left. Me and my alcohol, and by this time, a family. And so I came back to Georgia, and I called the Recreation Commission, and they said, we got an opening for a recreation director at Central State Hospital in Milledgeville. But by this time, my condition had progressed to the point to where that sounded pretty good. You know, I mean, I always wanted to fit in, and boy, did I, I believe I can fit in there. And sure enough, I did. I fit in so damn good there that a couple of times some of the employees got me mixed up with the patients. And I let them know right quick, he's a name tag, you know, read this. But anyway, during this time, my family had kind of grown into teenagers. And my oldest boy, he had a bad habit of collecting animals. And he brought home a baby raccoon. About a handful. He's about as big as my fist, you know. You can hold him in one hand. And we made a pet out of that raccoon. And as that raccoon began to grow, and I began to progress more in my insanity, I found out that the raccoon liked beer. And so... So me and that raccoon, you know, we got to be real good friends. Seriously. And the raccoon got really
too big to keep in the house. I don't know whether you ever seen a 35, 40-pound raccoon, but that's how big he was, and he was tearing up drapes and carpets and sofas and stuff. So we built a big deluxe pen out in the backyard with a top on it and a little house in it and all, just really deluxe for a raccoon. Not necessarily for a grown alcoholic. But hell, it was comfortable. Anyway, by this time also my wife had just pretty much almost gotten fed up with me, and she stole my house key, wouldn't give it back to me, and locked me out of the house almost every night. So I'd bring a 6-pack of beer home for the raccoon and a fifth for me. I'd just go back and get in the pen with the raccoon. Serious now. I'm serious. I told some of you earlier today you were going to hear some insanities, man. Man, you hearing some. I'm going to guarantee you. There's nothing, absolutely nothing normal or, you know, about this. But anyway, the raccoon, I'm going to tell you now, that raccoon finally turned out to be the last living creature that would drink with me. I'm serious. When your drinking friends begin to tell you you need help and offer to take you to treatment, you probably need help. And they were some of the first ones to tell me, man, let's take you over to Charter Lake or Willing Way or somewhere. I don't want to go there. Yeah. Anyway, the raccoon, I love to drink with that raccoon because, you know, he'd sit there, and as long as you had some beer for him to drink, he'd sit there and listen to me carry on all day. And never talk back, never criticized me, never argued, you know. He'd just sit there and drink his beer and listen. Man, I could just talk away all day. I'd just sit out there in the pen and get hoarse. Telling that raccoon all my problems. And it's strange how that part of my experience and journey turned out that he got the call of the wild. He wanted to buy him some Hooters, I guess. I <don't> And I couldn't help him with that. And I called the Natural Habitat Zoo in Albany, Georgia, and told them I had a pet raccoon about 35 or 40 pounds. God, that's a big raccoon. And I needed to give him away, and I couldn't turn him loose in the wild. They said, well, give him a tranquilizer and bring him on down, and I did. Drove him all the way down to Albany, and he put him out there. I hadn't gotten back to Milledgeville before this the caretaker down there. He was on the phone and said, Mister, how do you get this raccoon to drink water? I said, you don't. Pop him a beer. So the guy, you know, lasted about 3 weeks on that. He called me back to tell me that my raccoon was sober. Raccoon was sober. He's drinking water and liking it. So my raccoon, he got sober before I did, you know. And anyway, I kept on drinking and finally, my employer at work was telling me, you know, and I hate for an employer to do this, but he said, you know, Chuck, everybody likes you out here, and you do a good job when you come out here as recreation director of the Georgia War Veterans Home. That's where Jack and I first met. I was a recreation director, and he was a resident.
And we probably drank some together. Anyway, that's what I got fired for. Been with the state 18 years, and they kept telling me, you know, you cannot keep coming to work under the influence, no matter how good a job you do. You just got to quit coming to work drinking. And I didn't. I'd been there 18 years, and they fired me. And I want to tell you something. About that same time, my ex-wife, she got one of them no-fault divorces. She got everything inside the house, and I got everything outside. And to tell you the truth about it, Chet, I you know, I never had anything close to some of the experiences drunk that you had sober. I don't think I'd have made it. I just don't believe I would have made it. That was absolutely amazing. But anyway, I did finally took their advice, go to treatment. I went to treatment at the Veterans Hospital in Augusta. And I did pretty good and came home and went back to work at a nursing home. And I stayed there at the nursing home for a while and got fired from there because I didn't stay sober. First time, I went for about 3 months and went back out, stayed 3 years, and my bottom was really sort of different. I always like to share this because this can happen to you if you ever decide to go back out, and it hasn't already happened to you. But I went to treatment the second time, and they put me in the hospital, Veterans Hospital, instead of treatment. And this was on January 10th, 1981. And I couldn't figure out why they put me in the hospital until January the 21st of 1981, when I came out of an alcohol and drug coma that I'd been in for 10.5 days and was pronounced clinically dead twice. They had to use electric defibrillators and injections of pure adrenaline into my heart to bring me back to life. And when I came out of that and came to for the last time, there was a doctor standing beside my bed. And he told me, he said, "Chuck, God is not through with you yet. He has some more things for you to do, and I hope and pray that those things he has for you to do will be through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I had no earthly idea really what he meant. But I got to tell you, folks, I didn't know me. When I was out there drinking, I had no earthly idea of who I was. I told lies about lies and believed them. I didn't know the truth about anything. I didn't know how to tell it. I didn't know how to face it. I didn't know how to deal with the truth. Told you that I was a loving drunk, and I was. You know, I didn't know how to love. All my life that I could remember, feeling one way. Anything good that I got, I deserved it. I was supposed to get it. I didn't realize how self-centered and selfish and self-seeking that I had been all of my life. But that's a part of the disease that I have. And I told my sponsor, I said, listen, you know, speaking of love, I said, I used to be in love 1 week and out of love the next, in love next week and out of love the next. And he looked at me and he said, boy, you wasn't in love. I said, I wasn't. What was it? He said, you was in heat. I said, well, okay. Sounds okay. But I had no earthly idea this was going to be the kind of journey that it's been. And it's been almost the opposite of all the journeys that I had been on before. You know, I was constantly fearful of people, places, things, situations, circumstances, conditions, coincidences, whatever. And could not figure out why I was fearful of so much all the time. And why I would do so many crazy, stupid, insidious things as a result of that fear. And I started reading that big book, and it says in there, self-centered fear, chief activator, all our other defects of character. We're scared we're going to lose something that we already have, and we're not going to get something we demand. And that was me. That was me slapped to the bone. I was just that way. And you know, the strange thing about it, I can get that way at most any given moment today. God removed from this drunk the two major things that were causing me to drink. He removed the obsession. He removed the compulsion and the craving. And said, Chuck, here's the rest of it. You do it, and I'll help you along through others just like you. And that's the way it's been for 17 years. You people don't know how much I depend on you and what you share in meetings and what you share with me one-on-one and the fun and the pleasure that we have together. You know, I can remember having a lot of fun out there drinking, as I think someone else shared. I can remember having fun, really do. But you know what I can't remember? I can't remember that many moments of joy and really that many moments of true happiness and hardly no moments of freedom. I had locked myself into a self-imposed prison called alcoholism. I didn't know how to get out of it. I had no earthly idea. And I needed to be here long before I got here. But I wasn't supposed to. I got here exactly when I was supposed to get here. And everything that happened to me, from the time my fanny was slapped and I cried at birth to this very moment, everything that's happened to me had to happen exactly like it's happened for me to be where I am today in my sobriety. And I got to tell you, people, with rigorous honesty, I'm not satisfied with where I am today. I'm not going to be ever satisfied, because I have seen too many that were, and they're not with us anymore. They're not with us. God, I'd hate to know that I all of a sudden would start thinking that I'm as sober as I'm ever going to get, that I don't care how much longer I stay in this fellowship, I'm not going to probably get any more sober than I am or know any more about living sober than I know right now. Folks, I'm drunk already. I just ain't took to drink. I'm already drunk. because I'm thinking drunk. I shared with somebody at the group at the, yesterday at the 5:30 meeting that up here between these two ears is a bad neighborhood, and I cannot get up there by myself because I've been there by myself. And man, it's bad. It's fearful and it's uncomfortable and it's miserable and I don't like it up there. But you see, I've got you. And I've got a God of my understanding. And when I go up here, I take this with me and usually one of y'all. Because God's pretty busy. You know, so he just appoints one of y'all for me to take up there. And I talk to you. And you talk to me. And you tell me what I should do. What I shouldn't do. No, you don't. You know, you never have told me that. You told me what you would do or wouldn't do under the same circumstances. And just this journey that I've been on called sobriety is totally incomparable to any other journey I've ever been on in my life. And I've traveled all over Europe, all over Asia, all over the United States, Australia, Canada. I've been on a journey, folks, all my life. But the last 17 years have been the greatest. Because every day, I'm taken, if I'm willing to go, into a new part of my life. It don't have to be like it was yesterday. This is a thing that I heard a while back and I just really like it. It says that yesterday's history, tomorrow's a mystery, and today is a gift. And that's why they call it the present. I had never thought of that before. That is just the neatest thing, isn't it? That is neat. And then, you know, it says good orderly direction spells God. Found out something else the other day. 17 years old, supposed to know that. Nope, didn't know. Just heard it yesterday. Gifts offered daily. Isn't that something? And it's just really a good feeling to be sober. And I'm happy. I am just really in the worst days that occur in my life today. I seem to be able to bounce back happy and look forward to the next day or to the rest of that day. There's this business of sobriety to me is the most precious thing that I've ever possessed out there. I've never had anything. And you see, sobriety is spirituality. If you're sober, you have got some spirituality. Or you lying. You know, I'm serious, really. Because sober means that, yet I haven't had a drink today. I haven't thought about a drink today. I don't want a drink today. And I am practicing a set of principles in everything that I think, feel, say, do, or whatever, that this program is my life. See, in my house, we don't depend on miracles. We rely on them. Well, that didn't sound right. We don't expect miracles. I got it wrong. We don't expect them. We rely on them. That don't sound right either. Anyway, I am a miracle, and I'm happy to say that, and I'm about to run over. This has been a good sharing session for me, because I don't even remember what I've said, you know, but I hope I said something that might have helped somebody. If not today, you will think of it sometime later on, and it will help you. Because it happens to me that way. I can just have a thought, and I'm saying, where the hell did that come from? You know? And then I get to thinking back, so if I was a month ago, speaker over there in Atlanta or somewhere, you know, that's great. I got to tell you that you know, I've been on the journey of sobriety for 17 years now. And I've had the privilege of going to Alcoholics Anonymous in a lot of places. And it seems like everywhere I go in AA, I find myself in the presence of hope. They're everywhere. And in the presence of that hope, my faith in the God of my understanding becomes stronger. And in the presence of that faith, the unconditional love that we talk about and have difficulty doing sometimes becomes possible in my life. To love others unconditionally, you know. And between that hope, faith, and love, I have found out that we have a perfect member of our fellowship. Really do. He's called God, and he never misses an AA meeting. Never, ever misses one. He's always here in the fellowship of the Spirit. And folks, I know he loves you, and so do I. Thank you.